My name's Patrick. I'm definitely an alcoholic. I belong in AA. And I'm glad I have AA. And AA is a great place to be. AA saved my life. I wouldn't be alive without it. I'm pretty sure of that. So, and this is a group that my first visit, but I've heard about it and read a little bit on the website, and I think it's a great thing, you know. Bill Wilson said that atheists and agnostics widened the gateway to AA. And everybody is welcome in AA. That's the beauty of AA. I got sober in downtown San Francisco on Skid Row. So yeah, believe me, everybody was welcome in those meetings. It was like going to the emergency room at General Hospital. That's what the AA meeting was like. There was, anyway, the reason why I ended up there, it started out, I was born in Cavan, here in Ireland, County Cavan. I grew up there. I started drinking at a young age. My grandmother used to rub it on my teeth. She used to rub the whiskey on my teeth, and I always seemed to have a toothache, you know. They say in the big book, it says, I think they had a team of doctors work it out, and they said that they figured out that alcoholics drink because they like the effect. Well, no shit, Sherlock. I gotta tell them that. But yeah, they like the effect produced by alcohol. Isn't that a strange thing? But and I did, I just liked the effect as a child. I used to steal drinks, out of the cabinet that was in one of the rooms in our house. There was a cabinet. My grandmother used to put her bottles of Harvey's Bristol Cream, and then I used to cat go to shop to cash her pension check and to the post office. And the way back, I'd always get her a bottle of Powers Irish whiskey. She liked the little bottles, She called it her baby power, and she drank for medicinal purposes. There was no alcoholics in the family, none, none. There was none in the whole area. Never heard of an alcoholic anywhere growing up down there. There was some problem with the water. I think people had liver problems, but never heard anybody described as an alcoholic. Poor fellow, he had a weak liver. he died of a, what did he die of? He died of a, no, he died of a weak liver. So you'd hear stories like that, and you'd see people roaring drunk all over the place. And but there was no discussion of alcoholism that I ever heard. In my immediate family, my mother and father weren't really drinkers, which we dodged a bullet with that one. A young couple who met and fell in love and wanted to have a lot of children. They had 11 of us, and they devoted their lives to us. So, they did the best they could with what they had. So there was definitely no childhood trauma to speak of, which I'm lucky because I've sponsored a lot of guys, and I understand how trauma adds many more layers. Getting back into it, growing up, and enjoying the effects produced by alcohol, and it started getting me in trouble at a young age, because when we were probably around 12 or 13, myself and a few of the local lads, we would pool our money and we'd buy a lot of hard cider at school, and we'd get drunk basically. And I would get in trouble, and I started getting in trouble with teachers over stuff like that. And I had some problems at school. We'd moved to Dublin when I was 15. I stopped going to school at 15. I took a job in a factory in Dublin there as an apprentice. And then I just was really, really hated Dublin. When you come up from the country as a culture into the city, believe me, it's no place to be. So I was dying to get out of there. And I remember one night getting rip-roaring drunk, and that helped me make the decision to leave. And it seemed that I could use alcohol in that way. Alcohol will do for you what you cannot do for yourself. They say alcohol won't do anything to you if it doesn't do anything for you. And I would say that alcohol fueled my life in many ways at a very young age. So I left Ireland at 16, went to London on my own, and was very determined, always very determined, very, very self-willed. By the time I was 18, I owned my own home. I mean, I was just went there with nothing, you know, no education, no nothing. So I only say that to show you how self-willed can you can be a rip-roaring drunk and full of self-will and be quite successful on the outside. But every night I drank myself to sleep, every night. And I remember when I was 17 years old, getting in trouble at a job that I was in. It was, I had worked in the restaurant business. I was doing an apprenticeship, actually, in sort of high-end restaurants. And there was this restaurant we were living in upstairs. And I remember one night getting pissed off with the owner. And there was a big banquet room, and it had a piano, a grand piano, and this big chandelier. And in the middle of the night, roaring drunk, smashing the chandelier with a broomstick all over the piano and grinding it into the top of the piano. And I was going to leave. That was it. I was going to walk out. But I fell asleep. And in the morning, of course, the owner discovered what I had done. And he brought me in the office. And I would, like I said, it was 17. And he said, "You're a 17-year-old alcoholic." And he actually didn't fire me, believe it or not. And he was really a good guy. I could never find him to make amends, so I made amends in a different way. But, you know, so I could have qualified for AA back then in my teenage years. And I've met guys over the years who've gone into AA in their teenage years and are still sober. But, you know, I was very, very self-willed, like I said. There was no way I was going to admit I had a problem with anything. And so it took me, you know, going through a lot of, you know, I was always a worker, really work hard, if anything, a workaholic, always striving to get ahead. But it always seemed to be one step forward, two steps back, you know, and it was always to do with alcohol and then drugs. And then finally got heavily into drugs, you know, and especially cocaine. And by this time, you know, I was in my 20s and I was doing really well on the professional end and everything. I had my own business. And but I was just, you know, I was out of control with alcohol and drugs for sure. I mean, I'd gotten into speed as a teenager, and I would used to say, well, it helped me to keep working. You know, I never got drunk when I was on speed. Because you drink all day, all night. And I remember when I came into AA, guys were going, "Do you want a coffee?" I said, "I don't drink coffee." I mean, I never drank coffee up until that point. Yeah, who needs coffee if you got speed? You know. So, but the thing is that I never thought I would get so heavily into cocaine. I sort of did, and then I was earning quite good money. So I lost all, basically. And I left London in 1986, went to New York to get away from drugs. So not really, you know, the greatest move. I'd been going back and forth to the States since the 70s, and I'd always wanted to live there in any case, but I ended up in New York 86. By 1988, I was living in Los Angeles, and I had a sleeping bag, and I lived in a sleeping bag down off of Main Street. If any of you know LA, Skid Row, Main Street. That's and I used to sleep in a little park across the street from the Amtrak station, and I'd go clean up and I'd go to work. And somehow, you know, if we are very resourceful, we'll always find the money, always. And by then I was heavily into crack cocaine, and that was 1988. And so I always say that if I could do crack cocaine like a normal person, I'd still be doing it. But crack cocaine was my downfall. And I came into somehow through, I don't want to get into the whole rigmarole of the drunkologue too much, but you can see where it got me. And somehow, then I went up to San Francisco. I remember getting a Greyhound bus up to San Francisco. I knew some people up there. I knew the guy who was a drug dealer. and a cocaine dealer, and he let me stay on his couch. And I would try to go out and work, and part of my job was listening to him. If I just sit and listen to him for all night long, you know, chat, talking, and his girlfriend, then I could live there, basically, and give him any money I had. You know, just go out and get some money wherever you can get it, and give us your money, and then Jack would just talk. Now, he was a nice guy, but you know, he would just talk all night long. And Sharon, his girlfriend, she worked in the hospital at UC Hospital, and she used to work in the office, but she was in charge of buying things, and so she would order extra. So there was like a bathroom full of anything you wanted, uppers, downers, inners, outers, you name it. And then Jack with the coke and speed that he dealt, and weed. So it was just like a smorgasbord. I could have whatever I wanted. And somehow I hit bottom. I don't know what happened, but one day I'd been trying to stop. I tried everything in the ad infinitum list, and I couldn't stop. I couldn't. And so somehow one day I put down a drink, I put down a beer, and I walked out of the bar. And I don't know what happened, but something happened. And I thought, I never want to drink again. But I went for a week without a drink before I went to AA. And finally, I realized, you know, I'd heard about AA. I knew a guy who got sober in AA. And he set an example to me. He was another Irish guy. And he told me about AA years before in London, actually. And he'd been sober, and I couldn't believe that he got sober. I'd seen him under the arches at Waterloo Station, and Mets drinker. And I saw him, I actually worked for him. And he became my employer. He got sober, and he was a really good guy. And I remember him telling me about AA and trying to 12-step me, but I wasn't ready. But it's, you know, you never know when you're 12-stepping somebody. It could take years, but it's saying, but it maybe planted a seed. And so I thought if I ever got desperate enough, I'd go to AA. And so I remember one Saturday night going to an AA meeting in San Francisco. And the first meeting of AA went, that was in April 1989. And I went in, and there was maybe a dozen people, 8 o'clock on a Saturday. And it was not untypical of an AA meeting in San Francisco at the time, and there's many of them still the same way. There was a drunk guy, drunk out of his mind, sitting next to me, and he was disruptive and disrupting the meeting. And the meeting ended early, and the young chap who was secretary, really nice guy, he kind of lost control of it a bit. And so just decided to end it, and came over to me because I'd put up my hand saying I was brand new. And he said, man, you know, you put up your hand, you were a newcomer, I'm so sorry, you know. And I said, well, when's the next one? You know, it didn't, you know, the fact that it didn't throw him out kind of impressed me. And the fact that some woman was hugging him outside and he was crying on her shoulder and she was saying, it's okay, keep coming back, that kind of impressed me more than, you know, there being order in the meeting. That would have probably turned me off. You know, really organized meeting, and they give me an Excel spreadsheet to fill in a, you know, an inventory. But no, it was just like, that was where my head was at. And I do feel that if somebody's comes in brand new and desperate enough, that it doesn't really matter what happens at the meeting. And if, you know, it'll be right. And if they're not ready, and it doesn't matter what happened in the meeting, because it'll be wrong. So, you know, I don't see how good orderly meetings are necessarily a requirement. So, but anyway, I mean, it's nice to go to a good orderly meeting, but at least it's nice if there's a secretary and that the meeting opens. And there's sometimes readings that are nice to listen to, and I feel at home, especially when I'm traveling. I'm on the road a lot, and I'll go to an AA meeting, and it opens. There's a secretary, there's a coffee, there's my favorite, the slogans on the wall. And, you know, so I feel kind of a sameness. But what happened, what people say at meetings, it's never bothered me too much. But I wasn't listening a lot in the beginning anyway. So, but there was a lot of funny characters in San Francisco meetings. San Francisco meetings are very laissez-faire AA, you know, especially I lived downtown for that first year when I came in. And one of the things was that they were very active in helping newcomers, that's for sure. The second meeting, the first meeting I went to, everybody's coming over because I'm new and give me numbers and a schedule and where to go tomorrow night. So that was a Saturday. Sunday night, I went to a meeting called Friendly Circle Beginners on Sacramento Street and Van Ness Avenue. And that became a meeting that I went to for years. And a couple of guys, Jerry from Dublin and Bill from Cornwall, they came up to me after the meeting and took me for coffee. And they proceeded to just, we talked for 2 hours or so, and they told me about their drinking, and they were sharing crazy stories, and we'd sort of been around, all three of us had lived in London and New York and this and that, and so we kind of had a lot in common, and I could relate to their drinking, and what I was blown away by was the fact that they weren't drinking. That surprised me that they weren't drinking, and they seemed to be happy. They seemed to be having a good time. So they didn't tell me anything about a book. They didn't tell me anything about anything in terms of spirituality, about anything. You know, we were just telling drinking stories, actually, and crazy stuff, and it was fun. And it was just like the fact that they were doing it and they weren't drinking is what impressed me. And I thought, well, if they can do it, then any fool can do it. It's kind of like driving a car. I used to think that when I was taking driving lessons, working with this guy, he was fucking so all over the place, but he could drive a car really well. And I thought, okay, well, if he can do it, I can do it. Anybody can do it. It's kind of like was with them when I saw them. Shit, they don't drink. Well, what is it that they do? And they said, I remember they used to read suggestions for beginners at that meeting. One of them was, if you go by bars on your way home, normally change your route. I remember that was one of them. And it stuck in my mind because I lived, I didn't live in North Beach, but no matter what part of the city I was in, my way home was through North Beach. And because there were my favorite bars, four of my favorite bars were in North Beach, Vesuvio's, Specs, the Grant and Green, and the North Beach Saloon. I can still remember them all. They stick in their mind, and I would always end up in those bars, and start in one and end up in all four every time. So anyway, they said change your route, and this was 10:30 at night when we left the coffee shop, and I was thinking about which way I'd walk home. And I was thinking about what the guy said in the meeting, if you normally walk by certain bars, change your route. And it was in the back of my mind, which way am I going? Because I was kind of like in, but was I really in? And it dawned on me, And I remember Jerry saying, which way are you going? I said, I'm going down Van Ness Avenue straight home. And so I changed my route home. And I think I took the third step right there. I really do, because, truly, I think the steps are so simple. There's nothing complicated in AA. The steps as outlined are real simple. But there's something that happens, I think, in the individual. If they're ready, well, that's how I can only speak for myself, but I've seen it in other guys too. That because the third step is aligning the will with the will of a higher power or just a different way of doing things, everything and not walking by bars, making that decision. It was a good decision. And it was, I really felt it too, that I didn't want to drink. And so then I went to a lot of meetings. And then the following night, I met Jerry. We went to a meeting and they needed a coffee maker. And he said, Patrick will do it. I said, well, okay, fine, I'll do it. And so it was like that. It was very straightforward. I could see that people were very active in the recovery. And I could see there was, no talk of, at that time, at least in AA, I never heard anybody introduce themselves. Oh, my name is so-and-so. I have a sponsor. My sponsor's name's Frank. He's here. We both wear suit and tie when we go to, that was not San Francisco AA. That was definitely not San Francisco AA. That was, I hear it sort of noticed it on Zoom and I'm visiting other cities, of course. But San Francisco AA, at that time, remember, that was 89. So you had the AIDS crisis. And a lot of the meetings downtown, there were a lot of gay community would be at the meetings. The meetings were a mixed, of everybody. And there was a lot, and I think that added a whole dimension that was really interesting. It because these guys were dying, and they were the ones who were cheering us up. They, the gay community just added this level of humor and fun and lightness to the meetings, even though the AIDS crisis was going on. So that kind of blew my mind. That kind of, was something that was really interesting. And I think that San Francisco, still love San Francisco AA. And somebody told me there's some atheist agnostic groups which go back a long way in San Francisco. I never got out. They were out in the avenues. That was like going out to the suburbs. So I was downtown. I like to be downtown. And there was 10, 12 meeting rooms I could walk to every day. And a lot of the meeting rooms, you know where the meeting room was because there'd be the shopping carts outside. A lot of homeless people would go to the meetings just to get a cup of coffee. And there was something beautiful about San Francisco AA. There was a few people who became mentors to me. There's a guy called Frank, and Frank had been sober in San Francisco since 1946, and he was still knocking around the rooms, Frank Brannon. And Frank had something that was beyond, so obvious. They say that, sometimes they say, if somebody's really spiritual, they don't know they are. Who's the most spiritual? The one who doesn't know it. By their fruits you shall know them. And Frank was definitely one of those guys, because he led by example, and he didn't talk about he sort of spoke in riddles, it seemed. So it's hard to know where he stood, but he showed what he did, because he founded the City Detox Center. He founded a hotel for alcoholics called the Arlington, still there in San Francisco, for men in recovery. And he founded numerous halfway houses, some for women, for single mothers in recovery. Frank was the Brennan houses, and won awards, for altruistic work that he did, but very unassuming. So I learned a lot from people like him, how to live this life and or at least to attempt to in the best possible way. And I continued in AA, became very successful again business-wise in this, and I was still going to meetings for so many years. And I remember getting up to, and I had various phases of AA, the first 10 years, very gung-ho, meetings all the time, a lot of commitments. And then got busy, had a family, two children, wife who was very ambitious. And I got very distracted. It was very hard to keep up with everything. And like AA became something that was tick the box. Have I been to the meeting? Yes, I've been to the meeting. And I'd go through phases, and then I'd get back into it thinking, shit, this isn't working. I got to get a new sponsor, get some sponsees, and get back on track again. And then finally, after 24 years, I had a nervous breakdown due to a lot of too much work, too much distraction, trying to put kids through college. I mean, I bit off way more than I could chew. And I ended up first through not sleeping and properly and having panic attacks, ended up on the emergency room with that and taking the medication I knew I shouldn't have taken. And sure enough, I ended up, you know, drinking because I didn't like the medication. And I thought I'll just self-medicate, you know. And by then, my mind had completely gone. And I spent 5 years in a relapse. It almost killed me. And I was incapable of going back to AA. I would go once in a while to a meeting and I couldn't register, nothing registered. And I just couldn't sit still. And it was through, there was a suicide attempt. I ended up in the psych ward for the first time. I mean, it got really bad. And so what happened was my family and my first sponsee, Stephen, sort of corralled me and they conned me into coming back to the house and took me to a rehab, Henry Olaf House in San Francisco, a wonderful facility, the oldest rehab in the city and the best deal in town. They're about a quarter the price of most rehabs. It's a really good rehab if anybody wants to know. I can give you all the details, but wonderful place. It's over 60 years in the city, right in the city. And I ended up in there. And it took me a few days to detox. I was in bad shape, you know, a lot of librium. And but finally, when I came to, I was able to go into an AA meeting with the group. And I somehow felt completely at home again. And I threw in the towel. I really feel it. I just threw in the towel. I was not interested in anything except staying sober. That was my only interest, and it remains so, you know. And I got back into just doing exactly what I did, what I learned from Frank Brennan, what I learned from some of the great guys that were great mentors to me, some of my early sponsors. I got sponsor again, I got into the steps, I got into sponsoring guys, and I got into doing all the stuff that I'd learned in that early San Francisco AA way of doing things. And truly, I feel that I've had, you know, the word spiritual, it's not a religious program, it's a spiritual, well, you know, whatever. But that's, I live in LA, so the Southern California is like the epicenter of the spiritual industrial complex. I mean, it's just like spirituality is the word that gets thrown around. Oh, he's very spiritual. Look at the chakra cleansing he did over the weekend and all this stuff. But I really feel that I learned so much from just, you know, down and dirty AA and going to Alano clubs and AA meetings at the Salvation Army and places like that, where the true spirituality shows in how people are living their lives free of alcohol and drugs, and some desperate and some on cloud nine, you know. And it's just that mix that you find in an AA room. You can't find it anywhere. You can't find it anywhere. You go to a spiritual group, for instance, that might be Buddhist, and I've gone to these. And it's just that, you know, I don't like anything where they're all smiling at once. I'm not too sure. But AA, I just enjoy just the broad cross-section of humanity in the rooms, and there's something beautiful about it. And it brings the whole teaching in that big book to life, you know. Bill Wilson described AA as a spiritual kindergarten. Each man's theology, each man has his own, or what does he say? Each man's theology has to be his own quest, his own affair. Mind your own business. I love the my favorite way to work. If somebody has a problem with the God thing, and you know the steps are an issue, I would say work the slogans. the slogans. I love the slogans. I used to put them up on the wall. I was running a meeting. I always think of them as live easy, but think first, because they go in that order usually along the top. Live and let live. I mean, boy, you could just live your whole life on that one slogan. You could live your whole life on the what you call it, the golden rule. You know, do unto others. See what happened, do unto you. Live and let live. I write out my, you know, what that means to me from time to time. And I've shown sponsees through writing. If you don't write the step, well, write out what live and let live means. And easy does it. And but for the grace of whatever. But for the grace. And but think, and then think, and we turn it upside down. But that's a good one. We have to think. I mean, there's no way we can just stop thinking. It's just not, that ain't going to happen. So it's just regular, you know, trying to do the right thing. The right actions change, turn into right thinking. That's what they say in AA. Right actions turn into right thinking. Not the other way around. You can't think your way into right action. You can act your way into right thinking. So that's the way I think of that one. And or think the drink through. And then first things first. Just simplify, simplify, simplify. That's what that one says to me. Keep it simple. And remember the very first thing when I'm confused. Okay, what's the next right thing to do? That's all I have to do. I don't have to do anything else. I'm confused. I don't know how to handle the situation. Okay, what's the next right thing to do? Call Mark or call Liam or call somebody whose number I have and see how they're doing. You know, usually that helps. But, you know, or call a sponsee or call a newcomer or call whoever, you know, call my sister, see how she's doing. You know, so anything to get out of self, right? That's what we say. And then hopefully we'll discover there is no self. That would be the ultimate. But anyway, I think that's enough on me. So I'll leave it at that. I'm back now. I came back in 2018, by the way, after that crazy relapse. And I've been pretty much, you know, I got some kind of a gift out of it. I did, and it changed me in a way that, you know, it's hard to, it's just the way I feel about things or don't feel about things. It's just, I do feel that that was a near-death experience that changed a lot of my whole attitude and outlook upon life has changed. Where did I read that? in any case, I love AA. I love the whole process of AA and the AA community, and I'm very grateful for it. So thanks.